Well, this morning we start off a new series looking, of course, at failure. It's one I've been looking forward to for quite a long time. And that opening clip, I forget how old some movies are. That movie was back from 19, anybody know? 97. Oh, it's on the opening clip. Yeah, y'all cheated. Y'all cheated. Sorry, I guess I always put that on there. 1997. In there, there's a conversation between the mathematician who wants Will to go on to mathematics greatness and the psychologist who's trying to help Will go through life and sort of adjust to the issues and the traumas of his life. And they both have different ideas of his future and what his what future path he should take. And the reason for that is they both have different definitions of success and failure. And that's what that whole argument there is about. For one of them, success in life was all about the achievements that he would get and the awards that he would get and the recognition that he would get. For the other one, he didn't care about the awards or the achievements and what everybody else thought. For him, success in life was to go through life in a happy, well-adjusted manner, to have good relationships, and to find mental health along the way. And so the question is what is in the best interest of this child? What will make this kid successful? And when you don't agree on what is success, you also then, of course, don't agree on what is failure. And so I figured to start off in this series on failure, maybe we need to begin by defining what failure is, which on the surface sounds really easy. It sounds like it would be obvious what is failure and what is success, but failure is a hard thing to define because we define failure differently. So just take when you were in school. Now, when I was in school, remember there was a little chart up at the front of the room, and it told me what an A, what a B, what a C, what a D was. I don't know whatever happened to E, but we went straight on to F because F stood for failure. And if you got below a 65% of the questions right on the test, you got a failing grade. And so it was pretty obvious that if you didn't get 65%, there was a standard. If you didn't live up to the standard, you failed. Now, I don't know what they call it now. I don't know if it's called an E or just I don't know what they call it, but little Timmy's not going on to the fourth grade, so I don't know what you call that if Timmy keeps on getting E's or J's or whatever letter they put on it. You can call, is a failure by any other name still a failure? Yes, I kind of think it is. I guess I'm a little old school in that. So in one sense, failure is determined by a standard. There is a standard that sets what is a failing grade and what is a passing grade. And it all seemed pretty clear and pretty easy. Until the kid next to me got a B and said, oh my gosh, I failed. Now for me, I didn't understand what this person was talking about because this didn't make any sense. No, you didn't get a fail. You got a B. If you look up on the chart, that's above average. That's a good grade. No. And to them, getting a B felt like a failure. Why? Because they have an expectation of themselves that they're smarter than everybody else and so that they either deserve to get an A or always get an A. And so when you have a child like this that goes off to some school of higher learning, let's just say that they get into an Ivy League school like a Harvard where everybody there was always a straight-A student, the best of the best, you know what happens when they get to schools like that? They have a real problem because when they don't get an A and they get a B, they feel like they have failed. Or for some kids, they get that B in a school class, and for them, it's not the fact that they got a B that makes them feel like a failure. They're looking into the future and say, well, if I get grades like this, I will fail to get into the school of my choice down the road, or I will fail one day to get the job that I want. And so they're projecting future failures. Or perhaps maybe there's a standard that's set at home, and they know that B is not good enough to come home with, and so they know that they failed. They should have gotten better. They should have done better, and so they feel like a failure. And so I'm looking at this, and so now is failure by a standard, or is this by your own personal subjective, you know, sense? Like, am I determining what is success or failure for me? Regardless of what everybody else got, but regardless of what the teacher's grading scale is, failure is determined by what I determine as failure or success. But, you know, then there's a third group in the class. They get their grade, and they only look at their grade for a half a second, but where do they go? What'd you get? And they're polling everybody in the class. Why? Because I might have gotten a 64. And although that up there says it's a failing grade, when I find out that nobody else in the class got above a 50, well, now my 64 doesn't feel like a fail, does it? I feel like as if I'm the smartest one in the class, I've actually succeeded, right? And this did not exist at the high school I went to, but when I got to college, they had this thing called the curve, right? where you're hoping the teacher grades on the curve. And the curve basically is this bell curve type of thing where only a few kids are going to do well. Most of the kids are going to fall in the middle, and a few kids aren't going to do so well. And so these kids over here on the curve failed. But over here, although the standard said I failed, I don't really have any personal standards, so I don't really care what I get. All I care about is what everybody else get in comparison to what I got. And so because I use that as my standard of failure or success based on what everybody else in the class has done, as long as I'm over in this part of the bell curve, that's really all that matters, right? Because that is determined success or failure is how I perform against all of my peers. So it could be a set standard, or it could be a personal standard, or it could be sort of how I'm doing amongst everybody else. As I look at myself before God, I feel like as if I'm a complete failure. However, when I compare, never mind. Just kidding. Okay, but then there's even a fourth group of people when it comes to success or failure. And this is the group that they look at how hard the test is going to be. And so what do they do when they look at how hard this, what do they do before they even have to take the test? Because they see how hard this test is going to be. They drop the class. That's right. I don't know why you would study. Why study? The test is going to be so hard. Why risk failing in the first place, right? You just drop the class. Now, I know in high school you typically can't do that. I guess maybe studying was the right answer. I don't know. But what? And by the way, Jackson, if you were watching this right now, he's off at college. Number one, I hope that you are at your own church there in Charlottesville. If you happen to stay home, disregard what I'm saying right now for just a couple minutes. The one option is you can drop the class, and that means, you know, you just disappear. You don't take the class anymore. You tell the registrar, the class really wasn't for me, and so you just bow out. And if you do it the right time, at the end of the semester, it doesn't show up. Now, other people might say, oh, did you flunk out of that class? And you go, no, I didn't flunk out. I dropped the class. Well, to them, it may seem like as if you failed the class or you failed to take the class. But to me, I didn't fail it. I dropped it. It's sort of a perspective thing. But it really matters when you look at your overall grade point average at the end of the day. It doesn't come off as a failure at all. Whereas other people might accuse you of having failed, or maybe I failed to take the class, or maybe I failed to achieve my goal of passing the class, whatever you might want to say. All I'm trying to say in all of this is basically say, from the very earliest of ages when we first understood what a failing grade was, it was kind of hard to determine really what success or failure is, because it differs based on the situation or based on the circumstance, does it not? So maybe the best place to start with failure isn't and trying to come up with some hard, fast definition of success or failure, because there's lots of different forms of success and failure. Maybe we should start from a different place. And to do this, I want to go over to a quote from a guy named Nelson Boswell, who basically made a living doing self-help work. However, he does have a great quote when it comes to failure. He says, the difference between greatness and mediocrity is how an individual views failure. The difference between greatness and mediocrity is how an individual views failure. I'm going to modify that just a little bit for the purpose of this series and say the difference between success and failure is how you view failure. The difference between success and failure is how you view failure. That's what we're going to be working out over the next couple weeks as we look into failure. The difference in whether or not you've actually succeeded or whether you actually fail is determined by how you view failure. And the first thing about failure I think we need to understand is that failure is inevitable. It is unavoidable. You will fail. You cannot go through life and not fail. The only way you can go through life and not fail is if you fail to actually experience life whatsoever. If you just want to check out and never do anything, then of course, maybe that may be a path to never failing. But will you really have succeeded in even living at that point if you don't actually engage in life? You will fail. It is inevitable. It's a part of life. Now, anybody ever see the movie Twins? It's another old school movie. Remember, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito. The whole premise was there was this guy who was genetically, superior individual, and it was sort of raised in a bubble on a remote island. Do you actually know that that was actually based on a true story? That there was actually a guy who was, bred for his intellect and for his abilities, and he was raised in a bubble, so he wasn't exposed to all the kind of things that you and I were exposed to growing up, so he wasn't exposed to the immorality or to the advertising that leads to coveting. He wasn't exposed to all of the different environmental issues and problems that we have, that whole question of nature versus nurture, is it something you're born with or something that you're infected by society? He didn't have to worry about the societal question. The environment that he was put in was a perfect one. And also they were able to control things like viruses and disease And so he grew up in relatively excellent health, never had a struggle with any kind of illness or any kind of virus. And so he went through life in a very sort of controlled, sheltered environment with all of the perfect, ideal things to succeed. Now, with all of that going for him, how do you think things turned out? Do you think he succeeded or failed? Well, since the topic is failure, you're probably already jumping the gun and assuming he probably failed. However, you think on the surface he's got everything possible to succeed. Of course he would succeed. Well, actually, he did fail. And not only did he failed in epic fashion. He failed in an epic fashion so notoriously well-known that each and every one of you have heard of Adam. It is Adam and Eve, of course, what I'm speaking of right now. He was born in the perfect environment, an absolute bubble with no influence around him, surrounded him. He didn't grow up in an abusive home. He didn't have an abusive father, an abusive mother. He grew up in the perfect environment. He didn't experience any kind of health issues growing up. However, he epically failed, even though he was in the perfect environment. That's sort of the perfect experiment, if you will. And yet, his failure became all of our failures. The failure that he experienced became a failure that every one of us then experienced. It's almost like he doomed every one of us to failure after his own failure. So how and why did it happen? Well, I would dare say that the failure was inevitable. It was made inevitable simply for two reasons. Number one is, God placed the opportunity for him to fail, not just in the outskirts, not just in the possibility of the garden. Where did God put the one thing he wasn't supposed to do? Right in the center. Absolutely unavoidable, right? You know, sort of like if you put wet paint somewhere, if it's in the garage and I'm not going to the garage, it's not a big deal. But if you line the walls of everything in the house with paint, of course I'm going to touch it at some point because it's in the middle of everything. It's absolutely unavoidable. Like it's like where the dog sleeps. I can't help but step on the dog half the time because he sleeps right in the middle of the floor. Wherever the middle of that room is, the kitchen, wherever, that's where he's going to sleep, right? So it's not that I'm trying to step on the dog. It's just, what do you expect when you lay right there, dog? You know what I'm talking about? That's where God put the tree. He put the tree right in the middle. It was almost unavoidable. But not only did he put the tree right in the middle, what else did he do? He gave Satan unfettered access to Adam and his family. Have at it. You can talk to him anytime you want. Anytime you want, you're going to talk to him. Even if I'm not around, you can go talk to him. You're free to tempt him, lie to him, whatever you want to do. You can make the whole tree thing sound as enticing as you possibly want. Then you begin to ask yourself the question, why? Why would God do that? I mean, was failure not inevitable with those two parameters alone? I mean, if you put the temptation right in front of him, right front and center, so you got to pass it every single day, everywhere you go. And then secondly, you put somebody there, some active tempting agent right there to lie about God's nature and character, lie about reality, and paint out this temptation as though it's the next, you know, the greatest thing in the whole wide world that you're really missing out on if you don't experience it. What do you think is going to happen with Adam and Eve? Well, of course they're going to fail. Failure was inevitable. We know it was inevitable because before God even created the heavens and the earth, we know that he'd already decided he was going to send his son, Jesus Christ, down a cross for our sins, which means he knew ahead of time that this was all going to happen. This was a part of his plan. In other words, a part of the way that God has designed humanity is he designed us to fail. He knew we would fail. It was a part of the process. And now you're thinking, why? I never really thought about it in that sense. I don't like failure. It doesn't seem like God likes failure. Why did he design a process in which we would fail? Well, we'll get into that more throughout the series. I'm just going to touch on it for just a moment just to sort of settle your mind at ease so you can at least focus on something else other than that one question the rest of the morning. And that is, if you think about your failures, do they not bring you back into a closer relationship with God? Do they not expose your great need for God? Do you not fully appreciate God and who he is and his character anytime more than when you failed? Because it's when you fail that you realize that God has provided the grace for you, the forgiveness for you. You realize that in your weakness, he is strong, and you don't really appreciate how good something is or how strong something is or how valuable something is until you've broken it or you've lost it or you've walked away from it. And it's only then, once you're kind of on the backside of failure, that you realize just how valuable something is. And so God purposely designs in the system a failure for you to experience to help you really understand and appreciate the relationship that you have as an opportunity with him and who he is and his character. So if this life is about nothing more than you establishing, loving, and growing, and developing, and sharing a loving relationship with him, would it not make sense that he would do everything in his power to give you the best opportunity to enter into that relationship and appreciate that relationship and develop that relationship and grow in that relationship. And along the way, even if that means that failure is a necessary part of it, he'd bake failure right into the very fabric of the system. So I'm just going to stop with that, and we'll continue on with that over one of the next couple series in this message series on failure. So we need to think about failure as inevitable. And the second thing about failure is that failure is a process, not an event. We think of failure like when you get the grade. Like whatever the grade is, whatever you feel when you saw that grade and you feel like you failed, whether it be because of the standard or because of your own standards or because of how everybody else did or whatever it may be, when you got that, in the moment, it feels like it's an event. It's a thing that happened. When in reality, failure is a process. And when you don't realize that failure is a process, you will struggle to deal with failure. In other words, success and failure is determined by how you view failure. Number one, you need to understand failure is inevitable. You couldn't avoid it. It was going to happen. So you're not a failure simply because you failed. You're just human. But you also have to understand that failure is a process. You have to understand that failure is a process. The event of failure starts long before you actually experience failure. You actually fail long before you failed. I know Pastor Chris says it this way. He says, nothing ever happens all of a sudden. What happens whenever you experience a failure is somewhere along the way, you've experienced what I would call micro failures or undetected failures or unnoticed failures. In other words, you failed again and again and again. You just didn't realize you were failing. You didn't realize that what you were doing was leading to the ultimate blow up, the event of failure. Let me put it this way. When the space shuttle failed to come back to Earth safely and it blew up, they did a whole report and a study on that, and they found that there was a series of failures along the way that led to the big blow-up, right? What happened is there were little things about the tiles that were an issue with how they were placed. There were little things about how they did the launch procedures. There were something little things about how they examined the launch procedures, and there were all these little failures along the way that each led up to the ultimate failure that actually blew everything up. In the same way that when a marriage fails, did it just all of a sudden fail on Tuesday? Or were there lots of micro failures along the way? Things that didn't get said, or things that were said that shouldn't have been said, or things that went undone, things that went unnoticed. And every single day this happens day after day after day. There's all these little micro failures that all of a sudden leads up into the big blow-up argument. And it's not that there's the straw that breaks the camel's back. It's just that the camel's got too much straw on its back. And so it was failure after failure after failure after failure. When a child rebels and runs away from home, you know, oftentimes there's lots of failures, sometimes on the part of the parents, sometimes on the part of the community, sometimes on the part of the school. There's lots of things that can lead up to that one moment. There's lots of these little micro failures along the way. We see this in Scripture. If you go over and look at a case study of King David. Now, David was considered the greatest king in the Old Testament. And if you go over to 2 Samuel chapter 11, you'll see the lead up to his greatest failure. His greatest failure, just to cut to the chase, is where he makes a decision to sleep with the wife of a close associate, and then to cover it up, he has him killed. You know, and you're thinking, this was the greatest king? Yeah, there weren't a lot of good ones to choose from, but this was the best of them. Now, that whole failure, I want to read to you how this failure started, and tell me if you can pick up on the micro failures that led to the big failure. All right, so it goes this way in 2 Samuel chapter 11. In the springtime, the time when kings go off to war, David the king sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole army because Joab was the general. Anybody pick up on anything yet? No? No? Nothing yet? Okay. Really? It was the time when who goes off to war? Kings. And David is the king, and does David go off to war? No. So he's in the wrong place at the wrong time, right? That's failure number one. He's not where he's supposed to be. How many of the ultimate failures happen because you're not where you were supposed to be? Because you didn't show up, because you didn't go to class, that's why you failed the test, because you never showed up for class. But it was no big deal because the teacher doesn't penalize you for not showing up to class, so you didn't really think it was that big of a deal along the way. So he's not where he's supposed to be. It says, so David sends Joab out to fight the battle instead of him going. David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around the roof of his palace. Now, just so you know the layout and the setting, if you were the king, the whole idea of upper class, lower class, it comes from the richest people in society who lived in the highest place because it doesn't flood. The lower class people lived in a lower place. The middle class lived in the middle. So if you are the king and you're on the palace and you're on the roof of your palace, when you look out, you can look out over the tops of the roofs of everybody else's house. So it says, when in the evening, David got up from his bed, walked around the roof of his palace, and from his roof, he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. Anybody notice anything else in there? Anybody? Okay, he sees a woman, let's break it down this way. There's a difference between noticing a naked woman bathing and noticing that the naked woman that's bathing is beautiful. You get what I'm saying? In other words, you can just look and say, she's naked. But it takes a little bit longer of a look to decide, is it worth looking at or not worth looking at? Was she because let's face it, there's good naked and there's bad naked, is there not? You saw grandma naked, right? For some of you, that might be a bad thing. I'm going to stop there with that whole analogy. But I'll say this. There's no such thing as good guy naked. No, the guys don't look good naked, period. It doesn't matter. You don't have to look twice. You don't have to look at the half a time. It's never going to look good. But, you know, when you're looking at a naked woman, there's a topic where you go, oh, naked woman over there. Or, oh, yeah, naked woman over there. So if he can make a decision that she was, hey, I'm trying to explain to you the text, okay? But it's hard to pick up because even in the moment, you don't pick it up. He notices that she's naked, but he also notices she's beautiful, which means he did more than just notice that she was naked. He noticed that she was naked and that she was worth noticing. And so it says that she's beautiful. All right, let's read on. So David sent for someone to find out about her. And the man said, yeah, that's Bathsheba. She's the daughter of somebody you know. She's also the wife of somebody you know. She's somebody's daughter. She's somebody's wife. At that point, David should have said, oh, okay, man, I shouldn't have been looking at that. No, he says, David sent messengers to bring her up to the house. Do I have to spell that one out to you, right? Now, did they do anything wrong? No. Can't a man and a woman hang out and just watch a Netflix movie together sometime on the couch? Is there anything wrong with that? No, okay, right? Is it bad to send somebody a text just because I'm sending it? No, there's nothing wrong with just... We have 1,001 ways to rationalize out the things that aren't wrong that are actual wrong, right? These are all micro failures. And if you look at this and you accuse him of having failed, what would he say back? Okay, listen, you know, I didn't feel like going. I wasn't feeling good. That's why I didn't go off to war. Okay, I was tired. I couldn't sleep. I just got to look around. Okay, so I looked. I shouldn't have looked. Okay, I looked a couple times. Okay, I looked for a while. I shouldn't have looked, but it's not that big of a deal. We're just going to talk. We're just going to hang out. So she came over, and believe it or not, you would never guess what happens next. She actually slept with her. Wow, big surprise. Yeah. And then, never guess what happened. She actually got pregnant. Then he tries the whole cover-up thing. Now, where was the failure? Was the failure in, you know, when she came over, you know, not resisting temptation? Where was the failure? Was the failure when he invited her over? Was the failure when he looked long enough to figure out she's beautiful? Or was the failure when he wasn't even in the place he should have been in the first place? Yes, 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 yes. Now, eventually everybody knows about the ultimate failure, but uncovered through all of that is all the little micro failures that left up to it. And that's the hard part with failure, is that failure is a process. You are moving either on the path to failure or you're moving on a path to prevent failure. What do they always, I remember my coach used to always say this, if we fail to prepare, we are preparing to fail. If you fail to prepare, you're preparing to fail. This happens financially. Proverbs chapter 6. Now, Jackson, if you are listening and you didn't go to church this morning, please listen to this one. I made an appointment for him for a doctor's office when he came home to visit at 9 o'clock, and he overslept for it. I went and I was like, what? 9 o'clock? Come on, man. He goes, Dad, come on. That's really on you, not me. You have to know college students don't get up that early. Pay attention, son. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 9, the word of the Lord says, how long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? That should almost be the alarm clock, you know, tone for your kids, right? I know, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a thief, and scarcity will come on you like an armed man. What's he saying? He's like, you know, it's not a big deal when you sleep in. It's not a big deal when you miss work one day. It's not a big deal when you didn't study one time, right? But then all of a sudden, it's test day. All of a sudden, the mortgage bill's due. All of a sudden, you've got to come up with the money, and you don't have it, and you're surprised by it all of a sudden. But you see, little by little by little, little things happen. Like, I know nowadays it's typically TikTok and like little bits of reels, but what was the TV show that cost you at least a letter grade GPA average back when you were in school? Seinfeld reruns, Wings, you know, All in the Family. What was it? There was some movie, some TV show that was on nonstop on TV, and you watched that instead of studying more often than not. And it was all those, it was the failure to study day after day that led to the failing grade eventually. It was, you know, just a little bit of sleep, a little bit of slumber, you know, a little bit of putting it off, right? And then all of a sudden it comes on you like a surprise. Oh, I can't believe this happened. There's a pattern here. The spiritual principle is sowing and reaping. Over in Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 to 9, it says, God will not be mocked. You will reap what you sow. In other words, what you're planting today is what you're going to be growing later. This past summer, when Alex and Brittany went on vacation, Brittany was telling the story about how they've got a flower farm, and so she had just planted all of her flowers. And when you plant flowers, you don't plant flowers, you plant seeds, right? So I know the rest of us, we just go to Home Depot or somewhere, we buy flowers, we plant. I planted flowers. No, you plant them. Well, you're actually growing them, you plant seeds. And so she's planting the seeds. The problem is they were going on vacation for a week. And the seeds in the early days have to be watered every day. And so she hired this teenage kid. She goes, hey, I need you to come here. I need you to water my flowers. Here they are. And it was a dirt field. And she goes, listen, I know it doesn't look like flowers, but there's flowers in the field. You just can't see them right now. So I need you to water them every day. And you're going to feel ridiculous watering dirt. But I need you to water the dirt because in the dirt are the seeds that are going to become the flowers. And people might drive by and look at you, and all you're going to be doing is just spraying water hose all over the dirt. And it's going to sound kind of, you know, it's going to look ridiculous. And you're going to feel like as if you're doing nothing. And it even seems dumb for me to be paying you to water dirt. But it's actually, I'm having you do this because if you don't, I won't have flowers. And the reason why we fail to plan, and so we're planning to fail, is because it feels like we're watering dirt. What is the point? Like, I don't want to date my wife. I got married so I don't have to date. I'm not saying that. A lot of people do say that or think that, right? Right? Like, oh, so God, I don't have to date anymore. Right? No. When you get married, the dating is just beginning, really. It's a lifetime of dating. You need to be dating weekly and vacationing, you know, or getting away quarterly and going somewhere, you know, to just the two of you, even if it's, you know, just down to Pungo for the day. Just go do something, and you have to date and continue to date, and it's going to feel like you're watering dirt. That's probably a bad place to put that analogy. But the point is, it's going to feel like as if you're not accomplishing anything. But you're watering the seeds of the flowers that need to grow in your life. We talk about disciplining. We talk about, you know, when we do our child dedication. Disciplining, it says in Scripture, doesn't feel pleasant at the time. It's not fun to discipline, but you reap a harvest of righteousness because of it. And you don't feel like you're accomplishing or doing anything when you're fighting the little battles day in and day out over who's going to wash the dishes and wiping your feet up before you come in and making your bed every morning. And you feel like as if, what is the point of watering this dirt? But, you know, if you don't do it then, you have to fight those battles later. And it's a lot easier to fight those battles when you're bigger, stronger, and faster than they are. Like, you should want your kids to fail at home. Please, please, please let your kids fail at home. It is the best environment for them to fail. But if you cover up all their failures because you don't ever want to let Timmy to experience failure, at some point, failure is inevitable. Timmy will fail. Let him fail at home. Don't cover them up and create micro failures all along, which is going to lead to some big blow up later on. By all means, water the dirt. You know, people end up in this place where they just get so distant from God, and they wake up one day and they say, I don't even know how I got to this place. It's because you didn't water the dirt. You know, you didn't spend time in prayer. You didn't spend time with God. You didn't think it was a big deal to take a season off from church because you got focused on other things and got distracted. You didn't think it was a big deal. And you just feel like you come in week in, week out. Maybe you come in here and you say, I didn't get anything out of the message this morning. And so you leave. Next week you come in, I didn't get anything out of the message this morning. I feel like I'm watering dirt. Well, if you don't water the dirt, you'll never grow the flowers. It's the principle of planting and sowing. You reap what you sow. And if you're not going to water the dirt, you're not going to have what you want in the end. And so if you're, and I guess this is the question you really need to ask is, what dirt needs watering in my life? In other words, what are the micro failures in my life that I'm contributing to right now? What are the things that I'm not even aware of? And, you know, let's just break it down. In my relationship with God, am I watering the dirt? Am I watering the dirt in my relationship with God right now? Or am I setting myself up to one day not even know if there is a God, to be so distant from God I don't even know what happened, to get to the place where I don't even know what is right and what is wrong anymore because I've so lost sight of God? Or am I watering the dirt in my relationship with God? How about the relationships that are most important to you? It could be your marriage or the relationship with your kids or your close friends. Are you watering that dirt? Are you doing the things now? Nobody plans to have an affair. Problem is, they don't plan not to. They don't plan not to. And so it doesn't seem like a big deal that you get addicted to pornography or to romance novels or romance movies, and you get all this fantasized idea of what the perfect guy is going to be or the perfect woman's going to be. And then the more you have that fantasy idea of what the ideal image of a spouse is, the less they look like it in your mind. And the more somebody else begins to look like it, because you only see them for a little bit at a time, you don't really see the real them, and so it just spins up, and you have this whole fantasy world that goes on in your mind, and it's no big deal, it doesn't hurt anybody, it's a victimless crime, and nobody even knows about it, and then all of a sudden, one day, you act on it, and it all blows up in your face, and you wonder, how did this happen? I don't know. I know. You were watering the wrong dirt. You really were. You were watering the wrong dirt. And so you grew something over top of a septic tank. And that's why it was growing so well over there. Let that analogy marinate. The whole point is this. Failure doesn't happen overnight. It's a process. And if you can begin to think now about what are the things I can do to prevent the failure from happening down the road, or what are the things I am doing right now unconsciously that are feeding and watering the wrong flowers, the wrong things I don't want to be growing in my life, what is it that I can either stop doing or start doing right now that nobody else even knows about, that I'm not even aware of, to prevent the failure from happening in the future, or to get myself to a place where I'm sort of fail-proofing as best as possible the things that are most important in my life? So it's a process. It begins with the micro-failures, and then, of course, there's a failure. I'm not really going to spend a lot of time on that, because the failure happens like that. It's a moment. The process that leads up to the failure can be a long time. Sometimes it can be a lifetime. But the failure usually happens in a moment. You get the eviction notice. Your wife says, I'm leaving. You get the pink slip at work. You lost the job. You're out of the military. Whatever it is, it happens in a moment, right? And at this point, the consequences are inevitable. There's no way to get out of them. You got the test grade. You failed out. There's no going back from it now. It's happened and it's over. So I'm not going to talk about it too much, because it just happens in an instant. However, the aftermath of it, we have to focus on next. So it's a process. The part leading up to it's a long time, and the part after it it can be a long period of time. The moment, though, happens in an instant. But nothing ever happens in an instant, because we all led up to this. So the failure happens. The next thing is what's my response to it? What's my response to the failure? And I wish these two words rhymed, because they're spelled almost identically, but the way the English language is, sometimes things are spelled identically, but they just don't rhyme. Down and own. Same spelling, just they don't rhyme at all. Some people, they double down on their problems. They double down on their failure. They get caught in a lie, and what do? They tell an even bigger lie. They get caught embezzling money, so what do? They embezzle more money to pay back the money that they stole. And this actually happens. People will pay back. They get caught stealing $25,000. So they steal another $25,000 from a different account to pay back that one, so nobody even knows about it. Well, now you're guilty of stealing $50,000, right? And so people will double down on their crimes. They always say it's not the crime, it's the cover-up that was the issue, right? So it's one thing to be deceitful in what you did. It's a whole nother level of deceit to then lie about that whole deceit. And so for some people, when they experience a failure, they double down on it. Other people, though, they own it and they confess it. They repay what they've taken. They rebuild what they broke. They restore what's been damaged. And so they seek to own it as quick as possible and deal with it as quick as possible. One of the best case studies in Scripture is the case study you have between David, who we just talked about, and his predecessor Saul. David's sins were far greater than Saul's ever would by any barometer that you would measure them. David's great sin was, of course, stealing his friend's wife and having him bumped off. Pretty bad. Saul's big crime that led to his downfall was he was supposed to go and God sent him to basically be God's agent of judgment against a very evil king. So think about whatever horrible, evil dictator comes to your mind, okay? Now picture God has commissioned you to go take them out. Let's just say he's put you on a mission to go take out Hitler. And he says, listen, and I don't want anybody to think that you're in it for you, so you're not going to be, I don't want you to keep any of Hitler's stuff. It is all trash to me. I want it all gone. I want it all destroyed. And so that's what Saul is sent out to go do. And he kind of takes out all of this guy's army and whatnot and kind of cripples him. But he thinks to himself, you know what really makes a king look good in that day and time? When you have other kings in your prison. Because then you're like, you know, I'm a king of kings. See how models work right there? So I can be a king over other kings if I can keep him. It's sort of like a little trophy to, you know, have displayed all your friends, how big and powerful you are. So he decides he's not going to kill him. He's just going to take him back as a trophy. And Samuel, the prophet of God, shows up and he's like, hey, have you done what God asked you to do? He says, yep, sure have. Took him out. He's like, really? Because I could have sworn I just saw him over there. Oh, well, you know, I have him on hold, you know, because, you know, I'm going to teach him a lesson, right? You know, that's not what God asked you to do. Oh, and you're all supposed to destroy all of Hitler's stuff. Did you do that? Oh, yeah, yeah. Then why do I still hear sheep in the background? You're supposed to take out all of their stuff, including their livestock. He's like, and he goes, oh, soldiers did that, man. That wasn't on me. You know, I can't control everybody, right? Okay, well, I know I'm the king, but it's not like I can tell everybody what to do. You know, come on, what do you think, I am the king? No, I'm not the king. People do what they want to do, right? It wasn't on me. That was on them. I didn't have anything to do with all of that. Okay, well, could you take care of it now? Oh, well, come on. I don't really think we need to get to that extreme. And so Samuel goes and takes care of it all for him. And then Saul goes, okay, can we just keep this between ourselves? Nobody needs to know about my mess up here, right? Can we just cover this whole thing up? Can we put on a good show for everybody? He never owns it. If you read in 1 Samuel, what is it? 1 Samuel 15. He just doubles down and 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 doubles down to the point where finally God says, that's it, Saul, I'm done with you. I can't help somebody who won't correct their failures. In your failure, you just keep on failing and failing and failing and failing and failing. The only thing that determines whether you succeed or fail is how you deal with your failure. And if you're going to double down in it, you're just going to stay in it. But for David, what does he do? Nathan comes to him and says, hey, man, I got a little story to tell you. But a guy does something he shouldn't have done. And you're the guy. And David says, you're right, I am the guy. And if you read Psalm 51, you'll hear David's prayer to God about a guy who's confessing and say, God, I did it. It was me. It was all me. It was all my fault. I did it. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. Please forgive me. Please forgive me. The difference is in how you deal with the failure. And then lastly, another thing we'll be looking at over the course of the series, which I'm already out of time, but I'm going to tell it to you anyway, you have what leads up to the failure itself, your immediate reaction, but then you have your perspective on failure as you move forward. As you look back on that time, what is your perspective as you look back on that failure? For some people, they'll look back on it and it was always a failure. And it'll define who they are. I'm a failure. I'm a failure. That's who I am. And it'll define you and as you are and everything you do going forward. For other people, though, they look back on their failures and it was a learning experience. I learned a lot from that. That's where that opening quote comes from Thomas Edison. I didn't fail to discover how to make the light bulb. I learned 10,000 ways that don't work. And furthermore, I've got Tesla in the back pocket and I can steal all of his great ideas. He didn't say that in the quote, but that was also there too. Some of y'all get that. Some of you don't. It's a science joke, a history joke, whatever. Move on. They say a true entrepreneur never fails. They just learn more about how to start a business, which is why the average successful entrepreneur who started a business has at least 3 to 4 failures under their belt. As a matter of fact, the same holds true for church planting. You have at least one failed church plant before you're successful at planting a church. Essential was not the first time I ever endeavored to plant a church. There was a thing called New Hope. Essential was started out of the ashes and the crumblings of New Hope. Success comes out of your failure. What happens is you learn from your failures, and it's not a failure if you learn from the failure. It was just a learning experience. I think it was Henry Ford who tells a story, or the story is told of Henry Ford. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's told of him. I think I've also heard it said of Watson for IBM. So I'm not sure if it was Ford or Watson, or if it's just a fairy tale people make up because it sounds like a really good story, and so they attach some wealthy business person to it. The idea is there was a guy, an executive, who lost the company $10 million, and so he was called into the office. Whether it was Ford or Watson, I don't really know, and he thought he was going to get fired, and Watson or Ford says to him, fire you. I can't afford to fire you. I just paid $10 million to educate you. You know? If you leave, somebody else is going to make the same dumb mistake. So by all means, stick around and make sure we don't make that mistake again. And that's the reality of it. Have you learned from your mistakes, or are you going to make your mistake again? If you fail to learn from your mistakes, you are doomed to repeat them, which is why success or failure is determined by how you view failure. If you don't understand it's inevitable, you're going to struggle with your failures. If you don't understand that it's a process and how to work the process, you'll be worked over by the process and you will be doomed to continue in your failure. If you think you can run from it or cover it up or double down on it, that's going to fix it all, it's going to mess you up. If you don't learn from it and use it as a learning experience, it's also going to lead to an ultimate failure. And so to suffice for now, that's as far as I can get on this. I guess at the end of the day, I want to say this. Whether or not something was actually a failure cannot be determined at the event stage. When things blow up, you cannot determine whether or not this was a failure. It can only be determined much later on. How much later on? We'll get to that later on in the series. We don't want to close our time in prayer. Father, may we take comfort in knowing that failure was inevitable. It was predicted by you. You foresaw it. You knew that's what we would go through and experience in life. So much so that every single time we meet together, you've asked that we gather together and share in communion, which is simply a reminder of your remedy for our expected failure. So, Father, may we own our sins before you and our failure before you, make full confession of it, and come and receive the remedy that you provided for it. Father, may we also be aware, may you make us aware, Father, to be able to examine our life and to think through all of the micro failures right now that we're struggling with. We might water the dirt in our life that we need to. And in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.